Chapter 11. Chance in a Million. Chance is that unplanned occurrence which alters the shape of events. To the murderer, it's the break which permits him to avoid detection. To the pursuer, it's the equally unexpected opportunity to ensnare his quarry. In all human affairs, it is what John Milton called that power which erring men call chance. The mathematical likelihood of things happening by chance is defined by the theory of probability, and chance events are those which are not influenced by known causes. They are random eventualities, fate, risk, and accident, for chance is like a blindfolded person taking a card from a pack. The chance of a certain outcome taking place can be defined where the possibilities are limited. The chances of selecting a certain playing card are determined by the number of cards in the pack and also by the number of suits. For example, the chance of drawing a heart is 13 out of 52, or 3.25 times more probable than selecting a king, of which there are only 4 in the pack. Mathematical formulae can be used to work out the probability of a certain event happening. Prize-winning chances on one-armed bandits are carefully calculated, and insurance firms use probability tables when calculating life insurance premiums. There's no way of knowing in advance the life expectation of a particular individual, but experience of the risks inherent in different occupations, added to information about health, can reduce the areas of uncertainty. Each year, a certain number of men, within a prescribed age range and occupation, will die of heart disease. These are repeatable situations which are statistically reliable. The criminal has no probability tables and no reliable statistics with which to plan his enterprises. The intending assassin could work out the chances of his gun jamming or of the transmission failing in his getaway car if he stopped to think about it. They are predictable occurrences, against which he can take reasonable safeguards by servicing the car and the gun. But it is the million other possibilities, the fingerprint, the length of hair, a chip of paint, the workings of time, which provide the materials of chance. Conceiving of murder is a secret, hostile business, but its commission is public, because murder cannot be done in a vacuum. The chance appearance of a passer-by has spelled disaster to many a murderer's plan. Chance, in the hostile world of the murderer, is like some pathogenic organism. It lurks unseen, dangerous and challenging. As one of Ray Bradbury's characters discovered, it can't be eliminated absolutely. A man, having committed murder, decides to eliminate all traces of his presence at the murder scene. He wipes the telephone he's used, the table he's touched, the door handle he's turned. He becomes obsessed, cleaning everything in an effort to remove all traces of his presence. In a frenzy, he cleans the furniture, the walls, the floor, the ceiling, not once, but many times. Exhaustion and madness result. The power of chance is its unpredictability. On May the 22nd, 1924, the dead body of a boy was found in a culvert by a railroad near Chicago. 14-year-old Bobby Franks was found by maintenance men. He had been severely beaten about the head. Close by, an observant workman discovered a pair of horn-rimmed spectacles. A Chicago optical firm identified the spectacles as having special frames, which had been supplied to 3 customers. On their third call, the police found Nathan Leopold Jr., a 19-year-old amateur birdwatcher and a student at Chicago University. He admitted the spectacles were his. Leopold said that he must have lost the spectacles weeks previously while out birdwatching. Questioned further about his activities, he said that he'd been out with some girls and his friend, fellow student Richard Loeb. Loeb broke down under questioning and admitted to the crime. Leopold's confession was not long in following. The workings of chance had contrived to place Leopold at the scene of the murder. Those spectacles, which slipped from his coat pocket, ruined the perfect murder which he and Loeb had masterminded. Of all the items which might have been dropped at the scene, fate decreed that it should be an easily identified personal article. Thus was ended the infamous experiment in murder of Leopold and Loeb. 2 supermen were undone by chance. A question, though, remains. Was Nathan Leopold careless in dropping his spectacles at the murder scene, or was he, as some psychiatrists have suggested, acting from a subconscious wish to be found out? The calculating murderer will consider the degree of risk which his plan involves. He'll safeguard against the workings of chance in the same way that politicians, businessmen and militarists hedge their decisions. The commission of his crime is a professional business. The carelessness induced by impulse is ruled out. Every conceivable contingency is taken into account. But fate is there to play its hand in some freakish million-to-one chance of detection. Such a freak occurrence was the shark arm incident in Australia in 1935. Albert Hobson was fishing out at sea from Coogee Beach near Sydney when he hooked a shark. While hauling it in, his small catch was swallowed by a 14-foot tiger shark. Realising that he had an exhibit for his brother's Coogee Beach aquarium, Hobson called for some help to haul in the big shark. In due course, the captive tiger shark was displayed live to the paying public. On Anzac Day, April the 25th, 1935, 7 days after being hooked, the shark disgorged the contents of its stomach. Among the regurgitated collection of half-digested material was the unmistakable shape of a human arm. The dismembered limb was taken from the water by flabbergasted aquarium officials, and the police were sent for. The arm had a rope knotted around the wrist and a tattoo of two boxers on the forearm. With the aid of the tattoo and the fingerprints, the limb was identified as belonging to James Smith, a 40-year-old ex-amateur boxer. Smith, who was employed by Reg Holmes, a Sydney boat builder, had been missing for over 2 weeks. Police inquiries revealed that Smith had spent some time at a rented holiday cottage at Cronulla on the coast. Patrick Brady, a friend, had been with him. Brady, aged 42, was well known to the police as a forger and, at the time, was lying low while awaiting trial for forging cheques. The police could find no bloodstains at the cottage, but there was one curious fact. A tin trunk on the cottage's inventory had disappeared and had been replaced with a new one. Brady was arrested on a holding charge, but there was no doubt that the police viewed him as the number one suspect regarding the disappearance and the probable murder of James Smith. Brady made a statement in which he denied killing his friend, but he implicated Smith's employer, Reg Holmes, in dealings with forged cheques. On May the 17th, Patrick Brady was formally charged with Smith's murder. The millionth chance of discovery of the tattooed arm triggered off an amazing sequence of events. Holmes denied even knowing Brady, let alone being mixed up with forgery. 3 days after making this denial, Holmes was seen careering around Sydney Harbour in a speedboat. He had a gunshot wound in the head and smelled strongly of alcohol. Holmes's injury turned out to be only a surface wound, and he was soon discharged from hospital. He now changed his story to the police, telling them that Brady had admitted to him that he killed Smith and disposed of the body at sea in a tin trunk. If Brady was suspect number one, Holmes was now the key witness. However, on the eve of the coroner's inquest into the death of Jim Smith, the key witness was shot dead. Holmes was found in his car near a Sydney fishing wharf. He had 3 bullet wounds in his body, inflicted by a .32 revolver. At the inquest, Holmes' wife said that Smith had called on her husband, asking for money, and saying that he was in fear for his life. She also said that days later, Brady arrived at her home. He was dirty and unkempt and was carrying a leather bag. The implication was that the bag contained the tattooed arm and was proof to Holmes that Smith was dead. Doctors who had examined the arm agreed that the limb seemed to have been severed at the shoulder with a sharp knife. It did not appear likely that it had been bitten off by a shark. It was estimated that the arm had been in the water only a few weeks, and there were erudite discussions by experts on the digestive processes of sharks. On the important question of whether the arm came from a living or a dead person, the doctors could not be sure. They thought it was unlikely that a man would remove his own arm in this way, but there were precedents of people surviving the accidental severance of a limb. Brady's counsel challenged the authority of the coroner to hold an inquest without a body. He was overruled on this occasion, but tried the same tactic when the case was heard at Sydney Central Police Court. Counsel wanted to know how much of a body was a body. He used the novel argument that different parts of the same body might be found in 4 different areas under the jurisdiction of different authorities. In consequence, verdicts of manslaughter, suicide, an open verdict, and murder could be arrived at on the same body. Despite the power of the argument, though, Brady was committed for trial. The judge would not allow Holmes' statement as evidence. That was a blow to the prosecution, who had to rely on the admitted association of Brady and Smith, particularly during the last days that Smith was seen alive. But the police had been unable to find a single witness to testify to ill feeling between the two. 2 days were sufficient for the trial judge to conclude that the evidence was circumstantial. He directed an acquittal. No sooner was Patrick Brady freed than he was rearrested on a forgery charge. Although he was acquitted of murder, Brady was dogged by publicity about the case. It appeared that Reg Holmes had been murdered. Brady was safely in custody at the time, for fear of what he might say when he went into the witness box. Even without Holmes, there were strong undercurrents of violence, drug smuggling, forgery and fraud. In 1935, Sir Sidney Smith, the famous forensic expert, visited Australia and was invited by the Sydney Criminal Investigation Branch to examine the tattooed arm. He concluded that Smith's body had been cut up on a mattress on the floor of the cottage at Cronulla. The parts of the body were put in the tin trunk, which, when filled, still left an arm over. Unable to get the arm in the trunk, the murderer severed it from the shoulder and tied it to the outside of the trunk with rope. Sir Sidney supposed that the trunk and its contents, together with the blood-stained mattress, were taken out to sea and dumped. The arm worked loose and was eventually swallowed by Albert Hobson's shark. The tattooed arm, given up by the sea in such an incredible manner, brought little luck to those swept up in the whirl of events. Brady lived the rest of his life in the shadow of the shark arm case, Holmes forfeited his life, and 2 others involved in the affair met tragic deaths. The infamous arm was not preserved. All that remains of an incredible clue are the police reports, fingerprints, photographs, and a lot of questions. The shark arm case shows that chance is double-edged. No doubt, when the tattooed arm made its weird appearance, the murderer cursed his bad luck. If only he had bought a tin trunk large enough to accommodate the whole body of his victim, tattooed arm and all. As it turned out, the arm alone was not enough to betray him, but that too was chance. A woman who chanced to dream provided detectives with the clue that they needed to locate a murder victim. At the end of the First World War, 2 young army officers decided to form a business partnership. 25-year-old Eric Toome and 27-year-old Ernest Dyer started a motor business. Toome had £3,000 in the bank. Dyer had big ideas of motoring and horse racing. The first business failed, and a second motoring venture also collapsed. In 1920, Toome and Dyer decided to buy a racing stable and a stud farm called the Welcomes at Kenley in Surrey. Toome put up most of the money. Dyer moved into the farmhouse at the Welcomes with his wife and his 3 children. One night in April 1921, the farmhouse burned down. No one was injured, and Dyer swiftly lodged an insurance claim. The property had cost £3,000 to purchase, but Dyer had insured it for £12,000. The insurance company was suspicious, and Dyer did not press the claim. Dyer had expensive tastes. He indulged in fast women and slow horses. He borrowed money from Eric Toome. Then he forged his partner's signature on some cheques. This led to bitter accusations and quarrelling. Several months went by with no improvement in the business prospects at the Welcomes. And then Eric Toome suddenly disappeared. He wrote a letter dated April the 17th to his elderly parents in Kent. "I shall be coming to see you on Saturday, 21st of April." He never arrived. Toome's parents fretted over their son's disappearance. With the weeks dragging into months, the Reverend Toome put advertisements in the personal columns of newspapers. He also searched some of his son's old haunts in London's West End. All his questions met with blank looks. Then there came the first breakthrough. Reverend Toome went to a barber in the Haymarket, whose shop his son had frequented. Eric Toome had not been there for a long time, but he had introduced a friend, Ernest Dyer, the Welcomes, Kenley. The name Dyer meant nothing to the old clergyman, but he lost no time in visiting the Welcomes. Although Dyer was not at home, his wife was. The only information she was able to give was the address of one of Eric Toome's woman friends. Reverend Toome learned that his son had arranged to meet Dyer and 2 girls at Euston Station on April the 25th. The 4 planned a trip to Paris, but when they met in London, Dyer was on his own. He showed the girls a telegram, which he said Eric had sent. It read, "Sorry to disappoint, stop, have been called overseas." Next, Reverend Toome went to see his son's bank manager. The manager listened sympathetically to the elderly clergyman's story. "I don't think you need to worry about your son, Mr. Toome," he said. "We have a letter here which was written by him only last month." The clergyman inspected the letter, dated July the 22nd, 1922. "That's not my son's signature. This letter is a forgery," he declared. The startled bank manager looked up Eric Toombs' file. It told a revealing story. In April 1922, Toombs had a credit balance of £2,570. The same month, he instructed the bank to transfer £1,350 to a Paris bank for the use of Ernest Dyer. In July, there was a letter giving power of attorney to Dyer. In August, the account was heavily overdrawn. Reverend Toombs was now convinced that Ernest Dyer had fleeced his son and probably murdered him. But where was Dyer? And for that matter, where was Eric Toombs? The first part of the question was answered 3 months later by a stroke of chance. A man by the name of Fitzsimmons had advertised in the local papers at Scarborough in Yorkshire for men of the highest integrity to contact him regarding employment with exceptional prospects. All that was required was a substantial cash deposit. Mr. Fitzsimmons was about to initiate one of the oldest con tricks in the world. The police decided to ask him a few questions. On November the 16th, 1922, a detective arrived at the Bar Hotel, Scarborough. He asked to see Mr. Fitzsimmons, who took him upstairs to his room. As the two men reached the upper landing, Fitzsimmons made a furtive movement towards his pocket. Thinking that the man was intent on destroying some incriminating evidence, the detective seized hold of him. There was a struggle. Both men fell to the floor. There was a roar as a gun went off, and Fitzsimmons went limp. He was dead, killed by a bullet from his own gun, which he had kept concealed in his pocket. Fitzsimmons' hotel room contained a treasure of incriminating evidence. There was a suitcase bearing the initials E.T. There was Eric Toombs' passport and 100 cheques, on each of which was pencilled Toombs' forged signature. James Fitzsimmons, alias Ernest Dyer, had run true to form in his desperate efforts to make money. Dyer's attempted con trick through the newspapers gave him away to the vigilant Scarborough police, but the workings of chance had spotlighted more than a con man. Dyer had a good deal to hide, and it seemed that the whereabouts of Eric Toombs would remain his secret. It was another facet of that power which men call chance which led to the discovery of Eric Toombs. His mother chanced to dream, not of castles in the air, but of death. Night after night, she had the single, recurrent, terrifying nightmare. She saw her son's dead body lying at the foot of a well. 10 months after Dyer had been shot dead, the Reverend Toombs called at Scotland Yard. Superintendent Francis Carlin listened politely to the old man as he told his story and spoke passionately of his wife's nightmares. Carlin, a hard-headed policeman used to dealing with facts, nevertheless was struck by the ring of conviction in the Reverend Toombs' voice. "We'll look into the matter," he said. Within a day or two, Carlin took some men down to the Welcomes. The story of Mrs. Toombs' dream took on immediate reality, for in the grounds of the farm they found 5 disused wells. Carlin's men began to dig. The first well revealed nothing to reward their labours, the second was the same. But after digging away at the bottom of the third well, they found a human foot sticking out of the mud. Hours later, a body was dug out and taken to the mortuary. There, in a broken voice, the Reverend Toombs identified the corpse. "Yes," he said, "that is my dear boy." Pathologists found a gunshot wound at the back of the victim's head, which had probably been caused by a shotgun fired at close range. What led up to Eric Toombs' death at the Welcomes could only be surmised. It was assumed that Dyer and Toombs quarrelled, that Dyer shot his partner and then disposed of the body down the well. Questioned by the police, Mrs. Dyer recalled a night when she was alone at the Welcomes. Her husband was in France on business. At about 11 p.m, she heard a noise in the yard. It sounded like stones dropping against a drainpipe. She called her dog and peered out into the yard. The animal barked loudly, ran towards a disused shed, and a figure emerged. To her utter astonishment, Mrs. Dyer saw her husband, whom she thought was miles away. The noise which had disturbed her was the sound made by the rocks dropped into the well by Dyer to seal in Toombs' body. The part played by chance in the Toombs case was remarkable. No doubt thinking he was perfectly safe, Dyer promoted his newspaper con trick, only to be outsmarted by the police. It was a reasonable risk that did not pay off. But Mrs. Toombs' dream about the location of her dead son's body was an incredible glimpse into the beyond. Chance operates in all human affairs, but it seems to exert a special influence over erring men. The murderer sets himself above society. He alienates himself from the majority view, which holds life in high regard. His business is secret, and his task is to protect himself from a million chances of detection.